Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion about the very blunt and bleak assessment of the economy by President Obama's top economic official, Larry Summers, who warned of a Japan-like lost decade unless our sick economy, constrained by demand, is given a boost in confidence by borrowing, lending and spending. Timothy Canova, Professor of International Economic Law and Co-Director of the Center on Global Law and Development at the Chapman University School of Law, joins us to assess Summers' remarks and the likelihood of the White House listening to his recommendations. Then we will go to Istanbul, Turkey, to speak with Hugh Pope, the former Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Istanbul, who is now a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. We will discuss yesterday's election victory by the ruling party and Turkey's growing concern about the possible collapse of the Assad regime next door in Syria and the flow of refugees already pouring over the border. Then Tom Lutz joins us in the studio, editor of the forthcoming Los Angeles Review of Books. He just resigned as chairman of the Creative Writing Department at the University of California, Riverside, to protest the political demagoguery and corruption that is destroying an educational institution that was once the envy of the world. We'll talk with someone who's mad as hell that California's legislators, rather than educate the best of our citizens, instead enrich people who profit from imprisoning the poorest. Joining us now is Timothy Canova, who is Professor of International Economic Law and Co-Director of the Center for Global Law and Development at the Chapman University School of Law. His research crosses the disciplines of law, public finance, economics, and history, and he was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Canova.
Thank you very much.
And the warning by the top economic advisor of the Obamas, Lawrence Summers, in the, Sunday's Financial Times, I think was pretty powerful and perhaps somewhat overdue, given that most of the economic discussion is almost surreal. We're talking about a deficit crisis, or a hoax, if you will, not a revenue crisis. We're talking about absurdities like the debt ceiling, and we're not talking about unemployment and jobs.
Yes, certainly it was overdue. It's actually in Monday's Financial Times. And in his piece in the Times, he does talk about the, you could say, a different cause and effect than we're hearing these days in Washington. He talks about the deficits as a result of high unemployment, which is a very welcome perspective at this point. You know, there are about 14 million Americans who are officially unemployed, and perhaps another 10 to 15 million Americans who are underemployed or discouraged workers. That's a lot of people who are not paying their Social Security and Medicare taxes. Income tax receipts are down, property tax receipts, you name it, across the board for every level of government, federal, state, or local levels. The deficits are a result of this type of underemployment and unemployment crisis.
And that simple message has not been put out until now. I mean, you wrote a piece, Timothy Canova, critical of Austin Goolsbee, who still is the chief of the President's Economic Council, although he's on his way to the University of Chicago. And his whole rationale seems to be somewhat in sync with the Tea Party and others, who are basically making this argument that only the private sector can rescue us, and our problems are, well, Goolsbee suggests, I'm just quoting you, that it is proper for a government to take the lead in rescuing Wall Street banks, but when it comes to creating jobs for American workers, all the government can do is provide tax incentives for businesses to hire.
That's right, and we've seen that this approach has been completely ineffective. There was a piece last week in the New York Times that reported that for all of these tax incentives for businesses to be hiring, most of the response from business was to invest in capital and not in labor and to continue outsourcing jobs to overseas. So, you know, we can continue to try to provide tax incentives and hope that the private sector will respond by hiring. But there's lots of reasons to think, and Summers makes a good case of this in the Financial Times, that there are just not incentives for businesses to be hiring workers when there's this kind of slack in the economy. when consumers are underwater, out of work, and there's not real confidence that the demand will be there to sell the goods at the end of the day.
Well, America's largest corporations are sitting on more than $2 trillion in earnings.
That's right. That's right. That should be proof enough. Now, we've allowed the narrative to be recast that when you listen to the right-wing voices, they'll say that businesses are not investing or spending the $2 trillion because they want more assurances of lower taxes and less government regulation. But, you know, I think they really have this narrative backwards. With this many Americans out of work, there's just not the right incentives for anyone to be spending.
So, obviously, I mean, I don't know that it's obvious, but I suspect that the White House is not necessarily listening to Summers. But who do you think will? Because as we mentioned in the beginning, this his clarity on the real economic challenges ahead and the warnings that we are halfway through a lost decade a la Japan, and that we can avert a lost decade by recognizing the economic realities, which he's outlined, I think, in a very clear way. And, of course, it sounds probably to most people counterintuitive, but the truth of the matter is you cannot scrimp your way back to prosperity. You have to spend your way back to prosperity. And the Republicans have seized on this deficit hoax to and they want to use it, in fact, to cut what little we have of a social safety net. And you've got the Gang of Six compromisers sitting around drinking that Kool-Aid.
Well, it's true. Unfortunately, the Democrats allowed this to happen when they had control of both the House and Senate and the White House for the last 2 years. What did they do with it? They didn't move forward with any kind of public jobs and public training programs. Instead, President Obama created this Deficit Reduction Commission, which really skewed the entire debate towards deficit reduction. And for jobs, he created a White House Jobs and Competitiveness Council headed by the CEO of General Electric and Jeff Immelt, who in just today's Wall Street Journal has a piece talking about how they're going to create jobs. And it's really much the same. It's streamlining regulations and trying to match up workers' training with where the demands are, trying to liberalize visa requirements so that we can bring in more tourists and that'll help the economy. There's absolutely no recognition of the idea of public jobs programs in a depression. And I use the word depression quite consciously. You know, you can look at the 1930s, and most of the 1930s were periods of economic growth. After Roosevelt took office, there was one recession in the 30s, but otherwise there was economic growth throughout that decade, and still we refer to it as the Great Depression because there was mass unemployment. And I think we have the same kinds of conditions today in many ways. The official unemployment rate is 9.1%, but when you have the wider classification that the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses that brings in discouraged workers, it brings in those who have dropped out of the labor market, brings in part-time workers who want full-time work but can't find it, we're really talking about one out of five Americans are unemployed or underemployed. So it is it's a jobs depression. Consumers are underwater to a frightening degree, which continues to be a drag on their spending. There are all of these conditions that suggest we should be looking at the same kinds of approaches they used in the 1930s. We had a Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s that employed millions of young Americans on conservation programs in the nation's parks and forests, and including clearing underbrush and preventing forest fires. We're now looking at a fire season with what's perhaps the largest fire in Arizona history. It's gotten so big that the air in Albuquerque is going to become unbreathable soon. And it's in a part of Arizona, the fire is, with more than a 20% unemployment rate. And you can go right down the list. During the Depression, we had the Works Projects Administration that employed millions of adults, including Ronald Reagan's father. You had the Public Works Administration that built the Triborough Bridge, LaGuardia Airport. I mean, it's an impressive list of what was accomplished during the 1930s that put people to work and gave them hope. And that's wholly lacking in the discussion today. Larry Summers makes a veiled reference to this when in his Financial Times piece, he says that it's a false economy to defer infrastructure
maintenance and replacement.
That's right. And that the government should take advantage of this moment when 10-year interest rates are below 3% and construction unemployment approaches 20%. That's, you know, two sentences in a rather lengthy op-ed. It's not really a full-throated endorsement of major public works programs right now. And I think that's what's really needed in this discussion, that this public discussion about the crisis.
Well, but prior to that, he frames it in a way I think that's accessible, which is said that this, the situation can only be resolved by increases in confidence, borrowing and lending, and spending. And of course, that is a heresy to the kind of political debate that we're having. But somebody's got to call it as it is, that the deficit talk's a hoax. The debt ceiling is just stupid. We've got to get real here, and we don't have much of a social safety net. And if that is the agenda of the Republicans, to use a phony crisis to eviscerate what's left of a social safety net with Medicare and Social Security, then the Democrats ought to be putting it on billboards, for God's sake.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The bailouts, all the props for Wall Street and for the banks, whether we're talking about the trillions from the Federal Reserve or the hundreds of billions from the Troubled Asset Relief Program from TARP, they didn't just prop up the banks. They really propped up this whole financial edifice. So here we are 2.5 years later, and the credit rating agencies that are so implicated in bringing this crisis on to begin with by giving AAA investment grade ratings the subprime mortgages and securities, they are now in the position of being the arbiters of what's an acceptable level of deficits for sovereign nations. And when you look at what happened just really a year ago, the world was all in stimulus mode in 2009. And then in early 2010, it was Moody's and Standard & Poor's that started ringing the alarms, saying that Greece and some other countries in Europe were just incurring deficits that were too large. And by too large, it was 10% of gross domestic product. Now, that's not much different than what we have here in the United States now. And yet, when you compare it to the 1940s, to what actually got the United States out of the Depression once and for all, you know, it was World War II spending. It was the GI Bill of Rights and the Marshall Plan after the war. Well, at the peak of the 1940s, the federal government was incurring a deficit of 30 to 35% of gross domestic product. Now, who's to say that perhaps once every 50 years or once every century, the system gets so upside down, the distribution of wealth and income gets so top heavy, and the economy hits such a depression that governments may need to rebalance by incurring somewhat bigger deficits for a few years, putting people to work, recreating the middle class, finding big projects like a moon project or an interstate highway or a high-speed rail. But apparently, who's to say it's not appropriate is the credit rating agencies.
Well, I just don't understand, though, the people that supposed to be the party that's supposed to be more connected to middle class and working Americans and not necessarily so beholden to the billionaires who are doing so well, why they can't get out of their own way. And it's worth noting, Timothy Canova, that how much Summers has been vilified along with Geithner by the political left in this country as the enablers of the deregulation. And they've been thrown in with all of those that caused the meltdown in the fall of 2008. But it seems to me that actually Summers, we need more people like that instead of these sort of milquetoast, sort of centrist wussy Democrats like Goolsbee and Cass Sunstein and others, who seem to be all too ready to serve up government programs as sacrificial offerings and eviscerate the social safety net.
Well, that is true. You look at Goolsbee, Obama's chief economic advisor in the White House, and President Obama himself. Time and time again, they've said similar things, that it's the private sector that creates jobs. Goolsbee was being interviewed on Stephen Colbert's Comedy Central, and Colbert said several times the federal government has never created a single job. And Goolsbee just sat there. He didn't disagree with it whatsoever. And this is a complete slander. It's a complete misreading of history to say that the federal government has never created a job. The federal government has actually led the way in the computerization, the internet, you name it, through major public programs such as NASA and the Moonshot. There are some economists out there that have been saying things even, more far-reaching than what Summers is saying right now. Unfortunately, Summers waited till he was out of the White House to be making these kinds of pronouncements. But you have Robert Shiller. He's a Yale University professor of economics and finance. And a full year ago, he talked about the federal government creating a civilian conservation corps. And he said that for only $30 billion, which in the scheme of things, when we're talking about trillions of dollars for Wall Street, $30 billion is not that much. He said for $30 billion, the federal government could employ 1 million Americans in a civilian conservation corps for a year. We have the resources to be putting people back to work. The problem is we don't have the political will, and both parties in Washington seem to be captivated by a very right-wing, laissez-faire type of philosophy that only the private sector is capable of leading a recovery.
Well, it could be, at the risk of being cynical, Timothy Canova, it could be worse than that. It in many ways, it does seem that the Republicans have an investment in the economy not getting any better. Mitch McConnell already said that his greatest priority was to get rid of Obama. They're sitting on, corporate America's sitting on all this money that we discussed earlier. They're pushing all of this deficit stuff, which is counterintuitive because you don't cut spending when you're trying to stimulate an economy. So unless somebody, you'd think out of political survival, they'd want to step up to the plate, because only if the Democrats get a majority back in the House and in the Senate and pass the 60 threshold in the Senate, they won't be able to do a damn thing.
You're absolutely right. The Democrats at this point, in my view, should be raising these kinds of jobs programs, even knowing that the Republicans in the House are going to vote it down and prevent it from happening. They need to really present a clear alternative to the American people, just as a matter of smart politics. But beyond that, they've got to find the tools to be putting people to work between now and next election day. And they're somewhat out of tools because of the Republican control of the House of Representatives. One tool that they do have still is the TARP program. The TARP program is really a revolving fund of $700 billion that it was used to prop up the banks. It was used to get Chrysler and General Motors back on their feet, but it hasn't been used for much else ever since. There were some proposals a couple of years ago when TARP was first started of using some of the TARP funds to help modify mortgages on a mass scale, but that's gotten nowhere. And, the 1930s had their equivalent to TARP. It was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which at the outset under President Hoover, it was being used to prop up banks and insurance companies and railroads. And when Roosevelt was campaigning for president, he referred to that as trickle-down economics. He called for a recovery program that builds from the bottom up and not from the top down. And he called for using a portion of the Resolution Trust Corporation funds for loans for small businesses and farmers and homeowners facing foreclosure. And the Obama administration doesn't even have to go back to Congress. The Treasury Secretary has the authority right now to start using TARP funds. Like the Resolution Trust Corporation, it can make loans to state and local governments. The Resolution Trust Corporation did that during the 1930s to help pay for local school teacher salaries. TARP funds could be used to try to prop up this mortgage market and help modifications of ordinary Americans who are facing foreclosure. I'm not optimistic that the administration will use this, one of the last policy tools it has left. And part of it is ideology, and part of it is the fear of being called socialist again. And part of it is that they've got Timothy Geithner heading the Treasury, who, Treasury administers the TARP funds. I guess my frustration is they're going to be called socialists anyway. They've been called socialists for the past 2 years. And what they've mostly been practicing is socialism for banks and insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, but not for the middle class in any significant way.
Well, Timothy Canova, I thank you so much for joining us today to discuss Lawrence Summers' article in the Financial Times, How to Avoid Our Own Lost Decade. Again, a very strong warning, I think, from somebody that's been President Obama's top economic advisor.
You're very welcome.
Again, Timothy Canova is Professor of International Economic Law and Co-Director of the Center for Global Law and Development at the Chapman University School of Law. His research crosses the disciplines of law, public finance, economics, and history, and he was an early critic of financial deregulation and warned of the dangers of the bubble economy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back going to Istanbul, Turkey, to talk about tensions on the border with Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Hugh Pope, who's the former Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Istanbul and is now a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. He's the author of the much-acclaimed Sons of the Conquerors, Rise of the Turkic World, and more recently, Dining with Al-Qaeda, 3 decades exploring the many worlds of the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hugh Pope.
Thank you for having me.
The Turkish elections over the weekend, they obviously were good news for Mr. Erdogan's party, the Justice and Development Party, otherwise known as the AKP. But nevertheless, they didn't get the majority they needed to make fairly substantive constitutional changes. Is that right?
They're still going to apparently try to make a new constitution, and they will certainly be trying to do it with their majority. The thing is that they don't quite have enough to do it on their own, which means that they will have to fulfill their promise of doing it in a consensual and all-inclusive way. Prime Minister Erdogan has repeated the promise to bring everyone in on this, and if they can really do that, which no one in Turkey has yet managed to do, so we'll have to see if that's possible. But you know, the signs are quite good on things like Turkey's Kurdish problem. We've already seen that both the main opposition party and the Kurds are in parliament, and the opposition party has promised that it is ready to consider the kind of reforms that would go a long way to settling the Kurdish issue. And what's amazing about the Kurdish party is that all the big figures of the Kurdish movement are now in the parliament. So it definitely looks like parliament is a place that can at least make a good start on settling that major problem of Turkey.
There's obviously a lot of alarm, particularly from the military circles who have long dominated the politics in Turkey, about the so-called Islamist party. But it looks like they've proven themselves to be fairly moderate, haven't they, to the Turkish people? And what are these changes that they want to make to the constitution?
You're right that the extraordinary success of the AK Party has really pushed the army right back into the barracks. And we have this extraordinary situation now where 10% of the serving generals of the army are currently in jail facing charges on coup plotting. So that's that out of the way. The party, AK Party, Mr. Erdogan, they split with the conservative fundamentalist side of the old Islamic movement to create AK Party in 2001. And as you say, they've really proved to most Turks that they don't have a dangerous Islamist agenda. And I think that they will not try that in the constitution. It's certainly not something they promised to do. The problems are much more Turkish, shall I say. You know, we have a lot of questions about the authoritarian nature of the prime minister, about whether he wants to concentrate all power in a new presidency, and the whole question of, well, should parliamentarians all be immune from prosecution, and you know, what about the continued problem of corruption and underhand deals on state procurement and so forth. So all these things are things which would be good to see in the Constitution, but we don't know whether the reform program is really going to go ahead to clean things up, which unfortunately is one of the reasons that we're not seeing so much of that recently, is that the Turkey has really lost touch with its European accession negotiations. But, of course, that's another story.
Well, certainly a story that we can talk about in a moment. But obviously, Hugh Pope, again, the former Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Istanbul, where I'm speaking to him now, he's a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. Clearly, what's going on the southern border with Syria is a major preoccupation. And two questions there. The Turkish authorities on the border, particularly the military, are not being cooperative with the international press, and we know that the international press is entirely shut out of Syria. What's your understanding about that, and what do you hear from your journalistic colleagues?
Obviously, the government is keeping a lid on those refugee camps. I think that probably they don't want that part of Turkey to be some kind of loud hailer about all the terrible things that are going on in Syria. I think that, however, it's quite clear to everyone what has happened there, and I think the Turkish government is not trying to cover it up so much as not trying to make the situation worse. And it's also quite clear from what I've seen of the Syrian refugees who come to Turkey is that they have absolutely no desire to see their faces broadcast on television or their identities revealed, because they're terrified of what's going to happen to their relatives back home. So perhaps Turkey's actions are actually in the best interests of everyone, even though there is this huge international thirst to know exactly what's going on. And other than that, it's hard to make judgments, but certainly Turkey's very wide also perhaps about encouraging even more people to come. I think the thousands that have come already will probably be enough as far as Turkey's concerned.
And recently there was a meeting of the Syrian opposition in Turkey, which initially the Turkish government had taken a fairly pro-Assad line, but they seem to be somewhat more on the fence now. What's the sort of local Turkish reaction to it? Are the man in the street appalled by what's happening inside of Syria?
I think the reaction is the same as everywhere else in the world, with the added dimension that there's a lot of shared history and a lot of shared culture, a lot of shared sense of neighbourhood with Syria. But I don't think there's much pressure on the government yet to get involved in Syria. There's quite a reflex in Turkey that, for all the talk of being brother Muslims and so forth, that the Arab world is unstable and can drag you into trouble that you have not expected. And so I don't think anybody in Turkey is suggesting to the government that they should go in and do something about it. However, of course, Turkey is the country with, in recent years, one of the best relationships with the Damascus government, and has been trying to use its influence for months now to try and get Bashar al-Assad to come off the fence, to clamp down on his security-minded relatives who want to solve this with force, and to really do what at one point the Turkish government called the shock treatment of reform, and delivering this message through the unmistakable telephone calls of Prime Minister Erdogan, who is a very blunt person when he wants to be. And this has had no effect on the Syrian government, and Turkey has clearly got very, very frustrated about it, because it is creating instability on their border. But as I said, they can't go in, and I don't think at this point that anyone in the Syrian government is in anything more than survival mode. They're not talking about the reform program at all. And on the other hand, no one seems to have an alternative right now, because everyone's very scared of civil and ethnic strife in Syria. So they don't want to push Syria over the edge. And Turkey is, like everyone else, trying to prepare itself for whatever may happen. And one of those things, as you mentioned, is to host some meetings. Well, I say host is a big word. The opposition to meet here, no one needs visas to come to Turkey, so it's all very easy. And in fact, that meeting of the opposition was a very positive development, in the sense that it got the opposition thinking about policies, about what they would like to see in Syria after any transition, instead of just going for a very simplistic Assad out kind of agenda. And I think that that's very important, to develop ideas about what's going to happen next. And they came up with some. And I think you'll see in the long term that, yes, Turkey had a good relationship with the Assad family in the recent years, but that's because they ran Syria. They also have, which is something the United States or Europe does not have, is a very wide, broad, deep relationship with the Syrian people and Syrian cities, Syrian commerce, and Turkish companies have been investing there like mad recently. And so I think that when the transition happens, Turkey's going to be able to move in lots of directions to help Syria over the hump.
So, Hugh Pope, the fact that the Syrian Kurds are a part of the opposition, does that complicate Turkey's relationships with its own Kurds?
The status of Syrian Kurds is very complicated. As you may know, it's hundreds of thousands of them don't actually have Syrian nationality, and they are concentrated ethnically in one corner of the country, and they're also in major cities. And up till now, they have not been part of the events in Syria directly, it seems. However, I think at this point, the Syrian-Kurdish relationship is a discreetly Syrian problem. I think Turkey has got its Kurdish problem in an area where it's dealing with it on its own merits. As I said earlier, the recent election has put Turkey in a much better position to make a new start on dealing with the Kurdish problem. And 2 years ago, Turkey actually initiated something which it calls the democratic opening, which really on 24 or more policy tracks began to really give Kurds what they want in terms of human rights, ethnic rights, language rights. And I think this is a very good start. And over the next few years, I think we'll see Turkey moving to an ending of the continued insurgency in southeastern Turkey. And I think that dynamic is really protected now from Syria, particularly because Turkey has managed to solve its relationship with the Iraqi Kurds since 2007, and the Iraqi Kurdish leadership and Ankara are cooperating against the Kurdish insurgents in Turkey. So I think that Turkey is actually not very greatly, directly worried about what will happen to its sort of Anatolian homeland, if you like, from what's happening in Syria. I don't think it's particularly worried about its exports. I mean, exports to Syria, only 1% of Turkey's exports. I think it's much more concerned about the more general long-term possibility for instability in the Middle East as a whole that is represented by any future breakdown of Syria.
Again, I speak with Hugh Pope, former Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Istanbul. He's also a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. When you say that Turkey will have, they already have a lot of trading connections with Syria, and that after the Assads are over, which I guess seems like the assumption that you're making, which is intriguing, that one would assume then that Turkey would have more influence. The Israelis are quite alarmed at their relationship with Turkey having gone sour. And the analysis that we hear over here is that Turkey is taking a more independent path, dealing with some of the people that the United States don't like Iran, for example. So is this a zero-sum situation in Syria? Would this be Turkey's win and Iran's loss?
To say, I think currently, obviously, the Syrian government that's standing now has been forced more into the arms of Iran and Hezbollah, say its main allies, if you like, in the region, than before, but I think that in the long term, the positive dynamics that we've seen emerge in Turkey over in recent years are the future of the region. Yes, they are more independent of its traditional Western allies, especially on matters like Iran and Israel, where Turkey by no means is in any alliance with Iran. It certainly doesn't want to see Iran get hold of nuclear weapons. But it believes that the U.S. tactics for dealing with Iran have been completely counterproductive for the past three decades, and it thinks that engagement is more likely to have a long-term softening effect on Iran. That's its tactic. And on Israel, well, frankly, the problems with Israel have started mainly with Israel's attack on Gaza in 2008-2009. Up till the end of 2008, Turkey was playing an extraordinarily positive role in brokering a peace talks between Syria and Israel, which acknowledged by all sides to have been professionally and successfully done, up until the point where Israel decided it needed to deal with its Gaza problem at the expense of, for instance, relations with Turkey. And then we had last year the Mavi Marmara flotilla attempt to break the Gaza blockade, in which Turkey went into it thinking it had some kind of understanding that they wouldn't be attacked, but Israel blocked them from breaking the blockade and killed 9 Turks. And so since that time, relations have been very far down. And I think that until Turkish public opinion and the Turkish government sees a change in Israel coming more sincerely into a peace process or being perceived as such in Turkey, I don't think many Turkish governments will reach out to Israel. And that being the case, I think that one should be aware that it's not an Islamist, power-hungry Turkey that is seeking to provoke Israel. It's just a more independent Turkey expressing what most of its people actually think about what's happening in the region. And I think that's probably something the West is going to have to get used to in a lot of parts of the world as its influence wanes. And for instance, Turkey has an accession process with the EU officially, but the way the EU has alienated Turkey with its, for instance, France and Germany have explicitly said they don't really want to see Turkey in the EU, which is reversing 50 years of treaty-based negotiations. Turkey feels that it has some justification for going on its own way. But from our perspective here in Turkey, that's a very dangerous idea because, to tell you the truth, that the EU process in Turkey has been the locomotive for many of the economic improvements in Turkey in getting standards and investment safeguards in place that have allowed Turkey to become the regional hub and magnet that it's become. And it's also been the locomotive of the reforms and the new democratic ability of Turkey to conduct elections like we had on Sunday, which were undoubtedly extremely open, enthusiastically pursued, 80% participation, and very democratic process. But this has also been part of, again, from all the experience it's had in getting the country ready for the EU. And I think that in the long term, Turkey has to keep that, put new blood into that relationship, because the Middle Eastern neighborhood on the other side of Turkey remains dangerous and unstable, as we've seen in recent months. And I think that that's probably the main thing the new Turkish government has to do, is to really relaunch its European process and get the locomotive of reform and investment attractiveness going again.
Well, of course, the Turks have reached out to Europe on any number of occasions and they get slapped in the face, essentially, by the French and the Germans. And one wonders whether they perceive that as a kind of racist insult. I don't know. Frankly, I don't know how to characterize it. Do you?
It's been difficult for Turks to stomach the way that they have been treated. On the other hand, major European states can point at things that Turkey does that also they've overlooked in the interests of strategic relationships. Up until several years ago, torture was common, you could say, in Turkish jails. Now, during that EU process of recent years, that has been completely eliminated. Now, one hopes that they will deal with things like freedom of expression. You also have 57 journalists in jail in Turkey for generally non-journalistic crimes, but in Turkey that's a bit fungible, and you have hundreds of Kurdish nationalists in jail for non-violent crimes and crimes of conscience, if you like. So there are things that Europeans have to complain about. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, on the question the main reason that Turkey's technical negotiations with the EU have broken down is over the island of Cyprus, which Turkey has occupied the northern third of since 1974, in the interest of protecting the Turkish Cypriots, the 20% minority community there. Unfortunately, in recent years, when it started its negotiation process to join the EU, Turkey did promise that it would open its ports and airports to the Republic of Cyprus, the Greek Cypriot part of the island, as part of the progress towards the European Union membership that it was looking for. And Turkey hasn't done that. And as a result, half of its negotiation chapters are blocked, according to that one missing element. And that's a card that Turkey holds in its hand. It's held in its hand for the past 4 years. And it's decided not to play it. And while, as you say, Turkey accuses Germany and France of ruining the relationship and blocking progress, in fact, Turkey holds a card that it could play, but doesn't play, that would get the relationship going again. So, I think we'd be careful of blaming one side only.
Sure. Well, I thank you for joining us, Hugh Pope. It's been a very interesting conversation, and we're very grateful.
Thanks very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Hugh Pope, who's a former Wall Street Journal bureau chief in Istanbul and is also a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. He's the author of Sons of the Conquerors, Rise of the Turkic World, and Dining with Al-Qaeda, 3 Decades Exploring the Many Worlds of the Middle East. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with somebody who's as mad as hell about what's happening to the University of California and thinks the students should be too. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined in the studio by Tom Lutz, who is the author of the recent article for the Chronicle of Higher Education, I Am Mad as Hell in California, and Students Should Be Too. He's the author of the forthcoming Los Angeles Review of Books, and he was chairman of the Creative Writing Department at the University of California at Riverside until he resigned to protest budget cuts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Lutz.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And clearly the state of California has been in some dysfunction for some time because of Proposition 13 and the unusual requirement of supermajorities to pass both budgets and revenues. And it seems that they have just served up the University of California as the sacrificial lamb.
It's not just the University of California, also the California Community College system, the California State University system. It's the entire higher education system, which, of course, was the envy of the entire world, the greatest experiment in democratic higher education in the history of the world. And yes, it's been cut to tatters.
And you say in your article in the Journal of Higher Educations, or the Chronicle of Higher Education, Tom Lutz, the article "Mad as Hell in California and Students Should Be Too," that the you cite these grim statistics and in fact attribute it to the reason it's happening is because of political demagoguery and corruption. 35 years ago, the University of California received 6.6% of the state budget and prisons 3%. Now the university gets 2.2% and the prison industrial complex gets 7.4%. So the legislator is taking money that should be used to educate the best of its citizens and using it to enrich the people who make a profit from imprisoning the poorest. A very sad commentary.
It's a dreadful commentary. The figures about prisons I think particularly striking, since we know that there's a direct relationship between higher education and prison time. That is, the people with college degrees spend a lot less time in prison than people without them, for all sorts of reasons, including the ability to hire lawyers. But the idea that we're destroying the university system in order to save money, I think, the lie is put to that by these figures. That is, we are not. It's a question of priorities. It's not a question of whether or not there's enough money to have the university system that we've had in the past.
And as a department chair at the University of California, Riverside, you basically have, in the last few years, you've lived through this business of cuts. But it's, I guess, the metaphor is that they started cutting fat, and then they started to cut in to the tissue, and now they're soaring into the bone. Is that what's happening?
Yes, absolutely. The most obvious aspects of this are the simple class size issue, for instance. That is, one of the ways everybody has determined the quality of university education has been based on class size. The smaller the average class size, it's been assumed, the better the education. And we know that this is true. It's to do a philosophy seminar with 15 students is the way that it's been done. To do a philosophy seminar with 80 students is a travesty. There are people in sociology who tell me that they have not taught a course with under 100 students for 5 years. students are sections in science courses where they used to work with TAs. I've just been abandoned, and the teacher teaches a one section with 200 students in it. These are the kinds of things, and that's just the most obvious countable aspect of it. Students no longer get the courses that they need to graduate. Right? People are in college now for 6 years, seven, just shopping around, waiting until one of the courses that they need to graduate is available. But beyond that, the idea that you would actually choose the courses that were best for your path in life, that you would have a choice, is gone. Students sign up for whatever classes are available just to get the credit hours to move forward, whether they're interested in the subject or not, whether the subject is part of what they're working towards or not. It's a dreadful situation.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by Tom Lutz, who's the author of the recent article for the Chronicle of Higher Education, I Am As Mad As Hell in California, and Students Should Be Too. So you have the situation where the priorities have gotten skewed in a way that's frankly obscene, where we warehouse young, poor minorities in these prisons, a number of which have been privatized. For the so-called prison industrial complex, and a big part of it, of course, is the power of the prison guards union in Sacramento, which is now the most powerful lobby, making the teachers' lobby look pretty pale, I would think, by comparison. And you also have this ridiculous irony, of course, that when you say that the jails are not filled with people with college degrees, that obviously points out the absurdity of the situation. But what was great about the University of California system 35 years ago and why it was the envy of the world was that poor kids could afford it. I mean, it was about $5,000 or something back in the old days, wasn't it?
It was even less than that.
Even less than that, wasn't
it? Yeah. And even 5 years ago, when I started teaching at Riverside, the student body, 31% Latino. Of those students, 85% of them were first generation college students. It's still roughly 60% first generation college students. It's around 20% Anglo white students. It is the Access University for the University of California, the Access campus. So it's still providing that function. It's just doing it at a much deteriorated.
Right. So the beauty of it was that it gave you a world class education for a little money that regular working people could afford, and it really was a meritocracy. Right. And now you as somebody that's been on the faculty know all too well that they've just, you know, the budget cuts, which keep coming and coming and coming and coming, just keep reducing the staff down. You have no support. I've been trying to call people for my radio show. You can't get through to anybody because they don't have any phones anymore.
Yes, we took the phones out of our office 2 years ago.
I mean, it's insane. So
fairly minimal perk.
Right. So nobody can, you know, all of these right-wingers who are talking about how all these state employees are living off the fat of the land. Little do they know.
Yeah, and I should say that you brought up the prison guard union earlier, and the teachers union for elementary and secondary education. California, the UC faculty is not unionized, and we've been our own worst enemies in many ways. That is, every time a cut has come down from Sacramento, the faculty has figured out ways to try to not let it affect students. So we've a couple of years ago when we were all put on furlough, we took a vote as a faculty, and the faculty voted to take their furloughs on Sundays in the summer. In other words, we were going to make sure that we would not let this disrupt any classroom time. This is very noble as a general ideal. As collective bargaining, it was pretty stupid.
Well. One of the ways they've made up for the cuts, of course, is they keep charging the parents more and more. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that has the effect of making it less of a minority institution as it was, you know, making the scholarships scarcer. So in every respect, it's the worst kind of social engineering as a consequence of this. You mentioned in your article that all these legislators who keep making these cuts all have college degrees. I guess the question is, how much do they value education? The governor himself seems like a pretty enlightened guy. What's the problem here? Is it just because the state's broken, and until they get rid of those provisions in Proposition 14 that restrict the ability to pass budgets and raise revenues, the state's going to limp along?
Yes, I think the supermajority is the most obvious problem, a political discourse in which the idea of taxation is somehow it's impossible to talk about taxes as part of our common good. That's except as a four letter word. We are even though it's I guess five letters taxes. I think the legislators have a total. The 122 legislators in Sacramento have a total of 144 degrees from state higher education. Roughly 130 of those are from California institutions. In other words, they came through the system when it was affordable, when it was possible for anybody at performing it at the level that you need to, could go to the university, and they are. It's the worst kind of drawbridge mentality to just say, okay, that's it. Nobody else gets to go anymore. Now, I'm not entirely against raising tuition if there is offsetting funds for students who can't afford to pay the tuition. That is, I'm not entirely against. The sliding scale, which is in effect right now, I'm not against tuition going up even farther, as long as we ensure that the basic idea of the master plan developed 50 years ago remains in effect.
Well, I'm across the board though in this country, education, particularly the higher education, the federal government wastes billions on these. Absolutely ridiculous diploma mills that you have out here. On the freeways, you see the names of them. And what happens is that the federal government actually gives money to these kids to subsidize these bogus diploma mills that have a powerful lobby. They're the reasons why one of the most alarming statistics that I just learned recently is that the student debt in this country is greater than the credit card debt.
Yes.
And the way that it works is that these bogus diploma mills who give these kids a worthless education, they get all this taxpayer money, which goes to the kids in the form of loans, which are broken through private parties, the intermediaries who do nothing. They bring nothing to the table except, like the mafia, they charge vigorish.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up with all these kids with worthless diplomas and indebtedness. Now, it seems to me that If they break the University of California and you've got this other tier, they're going to come together and the whole thing will be a wash.
Yeah, and University of Phoenix, we can name the main culprit in this, right? Is an enormous corporation with a lot of power. It's exercising it very, very smartly. It's just not exercising it in favor of its own students. Everyone in higher education is aware of this problem Everybody in Washington is aware of this problem, and the money.
But they're getting lobbied by the
money talks.
By these guys that have these, and it all goes back. This is the hard part of it: it's the taxpayers' money, and the parents who get their kids hooked on these loans would obviously like the government to not to charge these interest rates, since the government is passing the money on. Why send it through a middleman? It makes no sense.
And of course, the main budget item for these for-profit colleges is their marketing. Right? They are very, very aggressive marketers. They go out
Well, I didn't mean to digress.
Yes, exactly.
Because we've got just a very brief time here. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you think the students ought to be up in arms. And now, they think that we're a bunch of old 60s hippies and we're living in a time warp. What's wrong with them? Why can't they get off their backsides?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. There's a million ways to talk about it. One is a general sense of disempowerment that's come from years and years of watching the public will thwarted by corporate interests.
But do they know if they all got together and lobbied hard and made life miserable for these politicians, they could get some results?
Well, I thought that the best thing that we could do as a faculty was to say, okay, you're cutting our budget by a quarter. That means there's no freshman class this year. And so that would across the whole system, that's several hundred thousand freshmen. That would be twice as many hundred thousand parents and four times as many hundred thousand grandparents and that many siblings all descending upon Sacramento and saying, this cannot stay.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio. It's been really interesting, Tom, and I'm sorry we have run out of time. Tom Lutz, again, who just quit in protest as the chairman of the Creative Writing Department at the University of California, Riverside. He's now the editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books. And I would like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. And this program is available at ianmasters.com. You can also check out my blogs there. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now.